perspective. But I am, and have been since at least 1987, very thoroughly convinced that most of the mistakes that are commonly made in the book of Revelation are a result of an unfamiliarity with Matthew chapter 24. I haven't really explained why that is yet. You'll have to wait until we get into Revelation, for the grand unveiling there. But that's why we're spending so much time on this. I'm very, very certain that if we can understand some of the symbology that we'll find here, especially tonight, then it'll help us tremendously when we get to the book of Revelation itself. So if you'd like to direct your attention to the screen here, as I say, we'll go very quickly through these two classes that we've already had. We started in Matthew 23, looked down through a very lengthy list there in which Jesus is just truly enraged at the religious leaders and at their followers of his time. Seven times he'll begin a statement with woe to you. In verse 14, he says they will receive a greater condemnation. Verse 15, they are sons of Gehenna. Verse 33, they cannot escape the sentence of Gehenna. Upon them falls all the righteous blood shed on earth, from righteous Abel to Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom they've murdered, there at verse 34. And then in verse 38, the actual threat is given that their house will be left to them desolate. I haven't taken the time to do it before, and I'm not going to go into any detail tonight. I do want to just mention this term Gehenna a little more thoroughly here this evening. That term is derived from Hinnom, or the Valley of Hinnom, which is right outside the city walls of Jerusalem itself. It is a notorious place in Jewish history. It is an abominable place. It is a despised place. It is here that children were offered in human sacrifice to various idols, one in particular, but it is a place that had come to have a particularly morbid horror attached to it for the Jews. And so this place, to be called a son of Gehenna, means that you either have the qualities of Gehenna, or you are in some sense related to, descended from Gehenna. And to say that you have the sentence of Gehenna upon you is to say that you have the proper punishment falling upon you that has fallen upon those that are related to this awful place. And so when Jesus uses that term, it's a little less familiar for us today. For the first century Jew, it would call to mind the horrors of their past history, which they now hated, and for which God had punished them. And it would then be a very powerful insult as well as a threat that Jesus is bestowing upon them. It would really have their attention and would call to mind then just awful, terrible, terrible things. You would not want to be a son of Gehenna. You certainly would not want to be subject to its sentence. Well, what's going to happen is that the house will be left desolate. The when question, of course, is asked. It was answered in Matthew 23 and verse 36, in this generation. We're going to bear some fruit on that passage again later tonight. So look at verse 36 in Matthew 23. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. I really can't emphasize too much, I don't think, that this passage is understood identically by every Bible student, I suppose, that's ever picked up a Bible. Regardless of the religious group you're affiliated with, regardless of your eschatology, that is your view of last things, everyone understands that when Jesus said that all these things would fall upon this generation, what he meant was, is that all the prophecies he had made in the 23rd chapter, most especially this one in verse 34, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of them you'll kill and crucify, some of them you'll scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. That verse 36 applies to those people that he is addressing at that time, and the punishment, the sentence of Gehenna, will fall upon that generation, which means the group of people that are currently living within their life's time. These events will take place. Everybody understands that exactly the same way. We know what the words mean there. Now, very shortly later, Jesus walked out of the temple having astonished the disciples with the declaration that that house would be left to them desolate. And so they were talking about the temple. They were pointing out the temple. They were beholding the temple stones and buildings. Jesus asks in the first verses of Matthew 24, "Do you not see all these things? These things you're looking at, these great buildings, not one stone here." This is to combine the three accounts, Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. These are all the expressions that are found when you put all three of those passages together. There is absolutely no doubt, brethren, about at least this. How many subjects are in view in Matthew 23 and in the first few verses of Matthew 24? And that is one. There's only one topic. There's only one thing they're looking at. There's only one thing they're pointing at. There's only one thing they're asking about. There's only one thing Jesus had prophesied about. The house would be left desolate. Not one stone would be left upon another here. They want to know about that. That's what the subject matter is. Now, this is beginning to be a very famous chart, mostly because of the mistakes that I've made on it. So, again, after I got done with my last class, Faye D'Ambrosia says, "You still have it wrong." Oh, no, I still have it wrong. The wind is supposed to go down there. Okay? So, for all of you that have, you know, faithfully written that down several times now, you know, been studying that, my apologies, but what happened there is it turns out the word "when" is an adverb. An adverb then came up on this line. Again, it hasn't changed a thing about what I've said. There's only one subject. There's only two questions. But in the actual diagram, the "when," that particular interrogative, should go there. Then, as you look down through the rest of it, you have a question that is what? What sign? What is the sign of your coming? And what is the sign of the end of the age? I made a big deal out of my little floating and rotating S right there. The word "sign" is not plural. It is singular. The word "and" that connects these two phrases together demonstrates unequivocally, absolutely, undeniably, irrevocably, that there's only one sign, and both of these expressions refer to that single sign. There is a sign of your coming, which is the same sign of the end of the age. And so what you got there is this. One subject, and how many questions? Two questions. Not the three that most people see in the passage. Grammatically, that is absolutely incorrect. There are not three questions. Logically, it is incorrect. Hal Lindsey, for instance, back in 1970, when he wrote The Late Great Planet Earth, said it's only natural that they would ask about the fall of Jerusalem and of the end of the planet. No, it's not natural at all. The only topic we have is the fall of the temple, the house being left desolate, and then of all those things that they were pointing at. They asked two questions, when and what will be the sign. And this because the sign of his coming is the sign of the end. If the temple comes down, then brethren, you tell me, what's going to come to an end if the temple goes down? What would they be losing if the temple fails? Just noticing that my batteries have gone dead here on the recorder, which is okay, because I have a backup over there. There are two microphones over there. But if any of you ladies have two AA or AAA batteries in your purse, okay. Anybody got two triples? How about it, Charles? You got any over there? Okay. You know, that's funny because I was just sure that I had brought some spirits here, but I don't see them right now, and I'm not going to look for them, so we'll worry about that later. Okay, so then we came to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3, where we're still asking now, reading the verse, "He was sitting on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming, and of the end of the what?'" End of the what? end of the age. It is not the word for world. It is not the word for earth, where we think of globe. It's not the word for planet. It's not the word cosmos. It's not the word oikoumene. It's not the word geis. It's the word ion or eon. It's a time reference, not a thing word. It's about an eon and not about substance. It's about time and not a thing. So, where we wrapped up our class 2 weeks ago was looking at verses 3 through 13 and what the sign is not. When you read all of the various books that are available today and have been, you know, for decades and maybe even centuries, in which all of them are claiming that these events will happen any day now in our time, the writers will get very excited about all of these things and say, see, they're all happening right now, so the end of the world is, you know, close. No, brethren, this is what the sign is not. There would be many false Christs, there would be wars and rumors of wars, famines and earthquakes, tribulation, murder and hatred, apostasy, betrayal, and more hatred. There would be many false prophets, deception, lawlessness, and people's love growing cold. But those things are not the sign. So in verses 3 through 13, what they should not do when they see these things is be misled or be frightened. Because according to verse 8, this is just the beginning. In these men's lifetimes, they would see these things. And so they are being told that the time we're talking about and the age that's going to come to an end is going to last for a while. These things will happen in your generation, but not next week, not next month, not next year. You're going to see this whole list of things unfold, and each of them, as they come about, should not frighten you, should not upset you, and you should not be misled by them. These things are just the beginning. What they should do is in verse 13, the one who endures to the end shall be saved. You need to endure to the end. Boy, I hope that doesn't come on. I'm reaching for my water now. Okay, so they're going to experience these things, suffer these things, and survive these things. That's what they are being told they must do. Now, we talked about God's time references a little bit. So 28 times the word you is used in this passage. All these things will come upon this generation in 2336. The gospel will be preached in the whole oikoumene, and then the end shall come. We spent all that time on oikoumene from Josephus to determine what the word meant to a first century Pharisee born about the year that Jesus was speaking these things. The word in this passage, which is from Wars 2:16-4, is oikoumene. I've underlined it here. It's defined here with the four borders, north, south, east, and west, of the Roman Empire. We studied that in some detail last week, but it's very important to appreciate that when Jesus spoke to apostate, unrighteous sons of Gehenna who could not escape their punishment, and Josephus would live to become one of them and witness the punishment as a young Pharisee, that to them, the word oikoumene, where the gospel would be preached when the end would come, meant the Roman Empire. This gets too bad. I'm going to cancel this class and send you all home. I really am. Thank you. No, I've got some of these here already. So, Josephus helps us a lot because the people that received this condemnation understood it in that manner. He's one of them. But still, we're concerned about the biblical definition of oikoumene. Where would the gospel be preached, and then the end would come? Luke chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, says this. I've put it up on the screen for you. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth, is the way the New American Standard translates it. First census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. The only place that a Roman emperor can make a census happen is where a Roman emperor has authority. When the New Testament at Luke 2 uses this word oikoumene, translates places the New American Standard inhabited Earth. It is the area that Caesar Augustus controls and counts. It is not the planet. It's not Borneo. It's not Alaska. You know, it's not any place else but the Roman Empire of the first century. So in Matthew 24:14, when the end shall come, we looked at Acts 2:5-11, Romans 1:8 and 10:18, Colossians 1:5 and 21-23, to see that in all these passages, we are told that the gospel had gone throughout the Roman Empire. We know who did it in Acts 2:5-11. We know it was done by 57 or 62 AD when Romans and Colossians were written. Pardon me again. So now we come to tonight's lesson, Matthew 24 and verse 15. Brethren, the when question has been addressed. We are told when it will not be. We are told when it will be. When it will not be is when they see all this list of things in 3 through 13. When it will be is when the gospel is preached to the oikoumene. That took place in the first century. Now the wet question arises. What is the sign of your coming and therefore of the end of the age? When are you coming to end the age? In Matthew 24 and 15, we are told, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Brethren, I'm so sorry. I'm just gonna take a break of about 1 minute. Let me just have you all pause while I take one of these and get a drink of water. Okay. Matthew 24:15. Brethren, everybody on the planet knows that term, don't they? The abomination of desolation. What was the threat in 23:38? Your house will be left to you desolate. In 24:15, what is the sign? An abomination of the same thing. An abomination that desolates is coming. They will see it. What are they supposed to do when they see it? Run! Flee, Diane says. You're supposed to get out of Dodge. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who's on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Let him who's in the field not turn back to get his cloak. Woe to those who are with child or nurse babes. Pray your flights not in the winter on a Sabbath. Brethren, is this the end of the world? Doesn't look like it, does it? So what is it? What is the abomination of desolation? Can you tell me?
The destruction of the temple.
Yes, it is.
The Roman army.
The Roman army, I hear. Prove it. It's all right to have an opinion. I want proof. How do you prove this to somebody? Get Jerry, I think, Beat Saber by a millisecond over here. What do you got?
Well,
No, it must be Saber then. Okay, there is an abomination of desolation, which in 15 was spoken of through whom? Daniel talked about this. And when you see it standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, for the sake of time tonight, I'm not going to do Daniel. Daniel opens up, you know, the whole book. It's fascinating, but it just takes a lot of time. Jesus said, it's in Daniel. I accept what Jesus said, so does everybody else. But I'm looking not for a prophecy now that's even older than the one Jesus gave, and I'm not looking for the prophecy that Jesus gave. I'm looking for the understanding of the prophecy. What is the abomination of desolation? Someone said the Roman army. I agree. Prove it. You can prove it, brethren, in Luke. This abomination of desolation, this destroying thing, whatever it is, this which will wreak such havoc upon that generation, is identified by Luke in his account of this identical event. When Luke told us about what is called the Olivet Discourse, when Luke tells us about Jesus being on the Mount of Olives, having this discussion with the disciples. When Luke gets to this place, he says at verse 20, when you see Jerusalem, what? Surrounded by armies, then recognize that her what is at hand? Her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea do what? Flee. Let those who are in the midst of the city depart. Let not those who are in the country and in the city. These are days of vengeance in order that all things which were written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are with child or those who nurse babes. There will be great distress upon the land and wrath of this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. It is not the end of the world. They're being led captive into other nations which still exist. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. What is the sign? The sign is the Roman army. When you see the abomination of desolation, when you see the desolating Roman army, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, by the way, it's plural, because Rome was a vast empire. And so they had control over a number of different kingdoms. And from these kingdoms, they conscripted, I always have a hard drafted, soldiers. These soldiers fought under the Roman army, but they also fought as units, so that you have several armies that are under the control of the Roman emperor. You also have, within the Roman structure, several different armies, such as, for instance, that 6th Legion that you'll see on some of the standards that are in the pictures that I'm showing you right here. Here's the 6th Legion right here. Now, the pictures I've just been showing you are as accurate as we can really get today, I suppose, for having the actual armor and the appearance of the Roman soldiers. If you ever get any chance to do, you know, some traveling in Jordan, which I realize doesn't happen every week, but the country of Jordan, which lies just to the east of Israel, has a number of biblical cities that are in what is now Jordan. Gerasa, or Gerasa, spelled sometimes with a J, sometimes with a G, E-R-A-S-A, is one of these. In 2010, my wife and I took a two-week trip to Israel, and of those 2 weeks, we spent 3 days in Jordan. I'm really glad for it. We went to Gerasa, which is this place right here. These stones are from Bible times that you see in the background. You are standing in the area that they would use for chariot races and gladiator contests and that sort of thing. And to this day, and several times a day, every day, they have these soldiers dressed in the Roman, you know, garb to put on formations and the actions of the Roman army. They show you the various things that they would do when they were attacking someone. It's about a 30 or 40 minute show. It is endlessly fascinating. I filmed the whole thing till my arm nearly fell off. And then, filming it all on a very hot day, just like this one, looking into the glare, I could not see in the little window of my high-definition camcorder that I had never pushed record. So I watched the whole thing through that screen for 40 minutes until my arm was ready to fall off. I got absolutely none of it on the video. I really would like to show that to you. If you go online, you know, you can find it. But the point of all of this, brethren, is that that army is the army that surrounded Jerusalem in the first century. Now, again, for the sake of time, I just cannot get into all of this. It can get extremely detailed. You could spend class after class after class on it. It's endlessly fascinating. But let me just encapsulize it like this. There are various Roman officials leading up to about 65 AD, which have been infuriating the Jews and offending them, and consciously so, and abusing them until the Jews were rising up in anger to revolt against Rome, which they did. When they revolted, Rome had to make a decision. Nero is the emperor at this time. He sends Vespasian. Vespasian sends his troops. Battles at Jotapata and Gamala, which you saw in the video on Sunday night, are the opening battles of what will become a 3.5-year invasion. At one point in this, Rome marches up to Jerusalem, brings its army, and as literally as you possibly can, word for word, syllable for syllable, letter for letter, these people in that generation saw what Jesus said they would. Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Josephus was there. Josephus writes about it at some length. Josephus writes about it as an eyewitness who is amazed. He's astonished. He can't understand it. And he explains in great detail that these Romans, they had Jerusalem. He says if they had only continued to press forward, the city would have fallen on that day at that moment. And then he says, I can't understand it. I'm paraphrasing, but he makes that point that suddenly, inexplicably, there's just no rhyme or reason for it, the Roman army withdrew. And when it did, then a lot of people fled the city. A lot of people got out. A lot of people decided, this is no place I want to be. And escape was possible because they came, they surrounded, and then they withdrew. There was a very small window, really small, so small that you need to run to avail yourself of it. Then Rome regrouped, came back around, and that siege would be unrelenting till he starved them out. They were eating their own children. They began killing themselves. Three-way civil war broke out. It was just horrific. But those who saw Jerusalem surrounded by armies and took it as a sign that an abomination of desolation was upon them and got out of the town as Jesus told them to, were spared. This is one of the most amazing events in world history, brethren, and it is told to us in the writings of Josephus by an opposer of Christianity, a hostile witness, by a man who is a Pharisee, and he is in the group that Jesus was talking about, although he wasn't born until that same year. He lived in that generation, so he's about 40 years old, 37 to 40, when all these things are going down. That kind of detail in the fulfillment of a prophecy that was uttered 37, 36 years prior demonstrates something, brethren, about who Jesus is. It demonstrates that he's the Son of the living God. It demonstrates that he's a prophet. It is proof positive that he now reigns at the right hand of God from heaven. He told them when this generation, house desolate. He told them what not to worry about. And then he told them when the end would come, when the gospel was preached in all the oikoumene. Paul maintains in all those various places that it was. Then the end would come, and what's the sign? The sign is the abomination of desolation. What's the sign, Luke? When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Now, brethren, I can't read Ms. Harris, and I know that we are told not to judge. So I have to always be very careful here. But nonetheless, I believed and taught this way, which you just heard tonight, since 1975. So I've been a long time singing this song. Since 1975, I've talked to an awful lot of people at Baptist churches and Methodist churches and every other church you want to name. And as I talk to these people, it's always amazing to me. They just act like Luke doesn't exist. They want to study Matthew 24. They want to tell you what they think the abomination of desolation is, but they don't want to tell you what Luke said it was. Now, I can't accuse people of doing this consciously, though I think quite a few must. They can't be that bad a Bible student. I think they know that Luke 21, 20 and following is there. But it doesn't fit their scheme. It doesn't fit premillennial eschatology. It's taking away everything they believe. So they don't want to study that passage. They don't want to deal with that passage. And a lot of them are just ignorant of it. Maybe the majority are just ignorant of it. But brethren, it's inexcusable to study Matthew 24 and not study Mark 13 and Luke 21. That's just inexcusable. These are parallel passages. These three men were moved by the Holy Spirit to record everything God wanted us to know about what Jesus said. So, Matthew records a lot of it. Mark records some things that Matthew didn't. Luke records some things that Matthew and Mark didn't. But together is the sum of God's word on the topic. What is the abomination of desolation, brethren? It's when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. In what generation? In that generation. Is it the end of the world? No. Because of what follows. Now, I just want to read it. We won't need to go into a whole lot of detail here. But start reading now, brethren, in verse 16. What are you to do when you see the abomination of desolation? Matthew 24, verse 16. Those who are in Judea should flee to the mountains. Him who's on the housetop should not go down to get the things out that are in his house. It's going to be really urgent. Don't pack for this. Just bolt. Let him who's in the field not turn back to get his cloak. It'll be so desperate you shouldn't even run home. In verse 19, woe to those who are with child and those who nurse babes in those days. Because brethren, if you're fleeing up the Judean hillsides, then you're carrying a baby inside or out, it's going to be way tough. And since you will never see your home in Jerusalem or anywhere around it again, you're going to be having that baby on rocks out in the wilderness. It's going to be tough, tough. And then it says in verse 20, pray that your flight may not be in the winter. For the same obvious question, they're losing their homes. They're told not even to go back and get any clothes. They're running with the clothes on their back to the Judean hills to save their lives. Nor on a Sabbath. Now, I know you've been through this, before, so you help me out now. Why not on a Sabbath? And does this prove that Christians were keeping the Sabbath? How do you answer the Sabbatarian argument? Well, see here, this has to be referring to their keeping the Sabbath, because if this happens on a Sabbath, then they have to just sit there and die. They can't take, more than a Sabbath day's journey. The Judean hills are too far away. So since they're Sabbath keepers, they wouldn't be able to flee at all like Jesus told them to do. That all sounds great, except for what? Marge?
The gates would be closed.
The gates would be closed. Since the days of Nehemiah and his book, we are told that God was very unhappy with these people. They were breaking the Sabbath. And so gates were then closed to prevent the people from centuries gone by, but to prevent them from going in and out and buying and selling on a Sabbath. Once that was established in Nehemiah's day, roughly 400 years before Christ, it endured to the time of Christ. On a Sabbath, whether you're Jew or Gentile in the city, you cannot get in or out of those gates. So if this happens on a Saturday. You would have to be lowered over the walls the way that Paul was. That's be the only way out of town. This is what he's talking about. Not keeping the Sabbath. Escaping the abomination is what he's talking about. Then it says in 21, there will be great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the cosmos, world, until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days have been cut short, question, will those days be cut short? Sure. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. No what would be saved? No life would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe in him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth. Behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will be gathered together. Vultures is a very much better translation than eagles. What kind of judgment is this, brethren? This is a judgment you can avoid. This is a judgment you can dodge. This is a judgment that Jesus does not want you to fall subject to. This is a judgment about which Jesus gives every conceivable warning so that they will not be there when it happens. Your house, Jerusalem, will be left to you desolate. Lord, look at it. It's wonderful. It's marvelous. It's everything to the Jews. See all these things? Not one stone here will be left upon another that's not torn down. When? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The end of the Jewish age, brethren. The end of the Mosaic age. The age of any Jew's ability to have a priesthood, to have sacrifice, to have an atoning system for their sins that is vested in that temple. That age that is entirely wrapped up in the functioning temple of Jerusalem must necessarily end when the temple no longer functions or even exists, which it has not to this day and never will again. It is just purely a myth. This idea that it's going to be built again and Jesus is going to come back and live in it so that Matthew 24 can be fulfilled. Brethren, that is just wrong, wrong, wrong. This was an escapable judgment that Jesus wanted those people to avoid. Which brings us then, brethren, to the big question. The hardest part of the whole chapter. The part where, even in churches of Christ, people start suggesting Jesus now changes the subject. Somewhere around 29 or 30 or 31 or 32 or 33 or 34 or 35 or 36, you'll meet people that are arguing for just about every one of those verses. Somewhere between 29 and 36, most people believe, and many of them, your brothers and sisters in Christ, that Jesus, in the middle of that river, changed horses. And suddenly he went to talk about the end of the planet. That what he's addressing here is no longer the fall of Jerusalem. It's got nothing to do with the abomination of desolation or the preaching of the gospel in that generation. That he changed the topic entirely. So, believing that, I see you all scanning, and I'm not wasting time, but talking the way I am to give you time to look at those verses. While you're listening to me and you're reading those verses, you're wondering, well, you know, have these things happen? People get to these verses and they say, well, whatever you said prior to this, 29 through 31 has not happened, they say. Erroneously, but that's what they say. And they're very confident in it. It absolutely has not happened yet. So, Either Jesus changed the subject to talk about the end of the world, and he's not talking about Jerusalem in 70 AD anymore, or there's three questions in Matthew 24, verse 3, and he is answering what the apostles asked. Because they asked, you know, about two different things. They wanted to know about the end of the temple, and they wanted to know about the end of the world. Brethren, the first one is grammatically and logically impossible. And the next idea here, that verses 29 through 31 have not happened, is just simply not true. Now, before we go on to deal with any of this, raise your hand if you think verses 29 through 31 spoken by Jesus about 30 AD have already been fulfilled. Raise your hand if you think they're in the past. These things have already happened. Okay, now go ahead. Raise your hand if you think they still lie in our future. I promise not to throw anything at you. Okay, there's two. Look, and there always is. Now, I want you to understand, we'll still be brethren and friends when we get done with this. So, you know, it's not like I'm going to throw you out of the church, or you have to fire me, I hope, as a preacher. It's okay to disagree on this. But let me show you why, brethren, I believe it is utterly impossible for Jesus to be talking about the end of the world here. First and foremost, before we even get to these verses themselves, I want you to go back and look at Matthew chapter 24. And notice something that I didn't really focus on much, but starting there, at verse 3, they asked when and what will be the sign. Jesus, in verses 4 through 13, is telling them what the sign is not. But note how the word then is the first word in verse 9. And that while verse 10 says, at that time, in the New American Standard, it is the exact same word in the Greek. So that either verse 9 could be translated at that time, or verse 10 could be translated then, they're interchangeable. But you have a time reference that's a very pointed one. It is at that time that I'm talking about that these things are going to happen. That word is used again in the middle of verse 14, then the end shall come. And 16, then those who are in Judea. 21, then there'll be great tribulation. 23, then if anyone says to you. And notice, brethren, that down here, and I have to be careful because there is one exception. There are nine times in Matthew 24 and eight times in Matthew 25 that same Greek word is used. And so the next one is in verse 30. Then, at that time, whatever he's talking about at verse 30 is at the same time, the only time, the one time, that he's been discussing in all the verses that led up to it. That word then is used again in verse 30. It's used twice. That same word, brethren, is used at verse, I've got to find it when I turn the page here. Well, that's it in verse 20, in chapter 20. No, it's in verse 40. Then there'll be two men in the field, one will be taken, and one will be left. That's the last time that it's used in Matthew 24. It also occurs in the next chapter as well. Then, nine times in Matthew 24. Brethren, what was their first question? When? And what's the answer? Then. He's giving him time references leading up through these 40 years to the all-important then of verse 14. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. What was their question, brethren, about? What shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? In verse 14, Jesus is still talking about the same end, the only end that they asked about, the end of the age. And then in verse 16, you're going to flee to the mountains. And then there's going to be great tribulation. And then in verse 23, there's be these false prophets. It's all the same time frame. So our task, brethren, is to look at these verses and say, what is he talking about? And is it possible that the terminology of 29 through 31 could refer somehow to the fall of Jerusalem and not the end of the world? So what does it say? immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then, the sign of the Son of Man will appear. Now, there's a translation difficulty there. Let me give it to you. There are two equally valid, totally balanced. It can be one way or the other, brethren. They are both ways to properly translate the verse. It could be, as you'll often see, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, which suggests that the sign's up there. Or it can be translated, I think, far more appropriately, the right way to translate it is, then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. The sign that the Son of Man is in heaven, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear, is an equally grammatically correct way to translate it. I don't think the sign was in the sky. I think Jesus was in heaven. Same word, ouranos. The sign that Jesus is in heaven will appear. So, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will gather together his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Let us think for a moment about Old Testament symbology in Isaiah 13. Come to Isaiah chapter 13. Now, brethren, this, for most people, is really kind of stunning when you first see it. But it would not have been so for a first century Jew. They knew these passages, and they knew their own scriptures, and they knew their own language. So, in Isaiah 13 and verse 1, we have an oracle concerning what city / country? 13:1 of Isaiah. Babylon. The passage tells us what it's talking about. There cannot be a mistake. It's Isaiah in the 700s before Christ speaking about Babylon. He saw this thing. Now, lift up a standard on the bare hill, raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I've commanded my consecrated ones, I've even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. He is calling his consecrated ones, his mighty warriors, his proudly exulting ones, to execute his anger. In Isaiah, as he continues, brethren, look down at verse 8. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They'll rise like a woman in labor. They'll look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel, with fury, burning anger, to make the land a what? And he will exterminate its sinners, how? From it. The land is going to be made a desolation, and the sinners will be exterminated from it. But does the passage say that the planet will be atomized? No. But 10 says, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man extinct. Anybody have a translation like that? No. It says, scarcer than gold. Is there no such thing as gold anymore, brethren? No, it says, scarcer than gold. There is gold, but it's scarce, and that's the way mortal man will be. Then, the Golgotha, 13. Therefore, I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. Now please look at the screen and start taking notes real fast, unless you have one of the booklets that I passed out last week. And if you don't, make sure you get one off the front pew here before you leave. Brethren, this is all terminology that you will find in Isaiah, as well as in Ezekiel, and in Daniel, and in Jeremiah, and in Joel. You find it all over your Old Testament. But what does it mean? What is this oracle about? Babylon. When was it written? 700 years before Christ. How, brethren, will it be fulfilled? Now, if you're thinking, well, there you go, Larry, this is talking about the end of the world, too, because those things have never happened. Well, all right, but let's read on. 14 says, it'll be that like a hunted gazelle or like sheep with none to gather them, they will each turn to his own people and each flee to his own land. But that's not the end of the planet. There are people and lands that you can flee to. In verse 15, anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered. And that's talking about rape, brethren, at the end of verse 16. Is that your picture of the end of the world? God's going to come down and start raping women? Killing babies? Is that your picture of the end of the world? Is it the Bible's picture of the end of the world? Hardly. 17. Now, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with verse 17? When after verse 1 tells you what country he's talking about, and then when he uses the terminology on the screen, he then describes it in terms of what happened every time an invading army of that century came upon another city or country. And then, in verse 17, he tells you what nation's going to do it. You know the history as well as I do. You know it from Daniel chapter 2. You know who the head of gold was. You know about the silver and the bronze and the legs, you know, they're iron mixed with clay. You know about those four successive kingdoms. You know about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. You know that. Well, the Medes are named, brethren, in verse 17. They're the ones that are going to fulfill it. And in verse 19, Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. I might add a little aside, even if Saddam Hussein tries. And he did. And he failed. Nor the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make flocks lie down there. Desert creatures will lie down there. Their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there, shaggy goats will frolic there, and hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her time also will soon come. Her days will not be prolonged when I vaporize planet Earth. That's not what it's talking about. Now, for every Jew, brethren, Isaiah's prophecy had been fulfilled when the Medo-Persians destroyed Babylon. And this terminology is the Jewish way of describing such a catastrophe. I was in the fifth grade when John F. Kennedy was shot. It was in a Catholic school. A nun, a terrified nun, burst through the door and shouted, "They have shot the president." Class was dismissed. We spent the rest of the day out at recess. Every nun went in to huddle in the office around a little black and white television set. Brethren, it was a dark, dark day in American history, wasn't it? It was not, and you know it. So I was in Southern California, and it was a clear blue sky, and I spent the whole day playing football with my friends. Wasn't nothing dark about it at all. What do you say it's a dark day? Wasn't it a dark day? It's probably 75 degrees, sunshining, where I was in Southern California. Was it a dark day? That was a dark day, wasn't it? When we say that was a dark day, what do we mean? We're not talking about, we mean it was a horrible day. How did a Jew say it's a dark day? Well, brethren, if there's no sun, and there's no moon, and there's no stars, how dark is it? That's the way they did it. For them to describe an event like Babylon being destroyed, they used this kind of terminology. The Medes and the Persians fulfilled it. Every historian knows about it. It's not the end of the world. Now, Jesus uses that exact same terminology, but he told us where, Jerusalem. He told us why, because of the sins of Matthew 23. He told us when in Matthew 23:36 it would be in that generation. Now look at Matthew chapter 24. We'll close out our class. I've got just the right time here for this. Now, here's all that terminology, brethren, but the next verse is 32. Learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things. We started off with all these things. Do you not see all these things? He's still talking about all these things. Recognize that he's near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Now, brethren, verse 34, look at it. Read it slowly. Let it sink in and just digest what verse 34 says. Then turn back to 23:36. Read 23:36. Read it slowly. Digest it. There is 100% unanimity on what 23:36 means. It means all these things I'm talking about, everything I've said up to this verse, will take place within the lifetimes of the people I'm talking to. Why, brethren, one chapter later, at 24:36, when verbatim that same sentence is repeated, would it mean something else? Why would it suddenly not mean what it meant in 23:36? Why would it suddenly not be referring to the generation that's standing there that he's talking to? Why would there be a 2,000-year gap and leap into the far distant future and still unfulfilled to this day? We're just hoping it will sometime. Why, when everybody knows what words mean in 23:36, do they change those words in 24:34? I know only one reason why anyone would do that. It's because they have a preconceived notion about what we're talking about in Matthew 24. We said 29 through 31 could not have happened because I still see the moon out there tonight and the sun in the morning. Therefore, 34 can't mean what it says. Those things did not happen in that generation. It's got to mean something else. Brethren, that is a major problem. Jesus never took a breath between 23 and 24. They walked for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I've taken that walk myself. And in the course of that time, they had one subject and two questions. When? And what will be the sign? They wanted to know about the end of the Jewish age. That's the only thing that's under discussion. They were told when it wouldn't be, when it would be, and what the sign would be. And in that generation, all those things took place. And then, brethren, the sky fell on Jerusalem. Didn't it? Yes, it did. And I've seen those stones and I've touched those stones. There's not one left on another in that temple. And there never will be reassembled. So, brethren, when God's keeping time and these two are identical, then just maybe they might be identical. Don't you think? So too. Now, I am going to take just a minute here. We'll go very quickly. But 35 through 51, you go home and study it. If you have questions about it, bring them to me next week, and we'll spend some time on it if we need to. But here's what you've got in those passages. What you've got is Jesus using parables and examples to say exactly the same thing five times. He has said, only God knows, but it will be this generation. You don't know the day, but you do know the generation. so, it'll be like Noah's day. God has said, there's a big rain coming, but Noah didn't know when. It'll be like that. It'll be like 40 through 42. It'll be like a thief. It'll be like a slave. In every case, he tells you what it will be like. And it is not like a global desolation. It's not what it's like. What it's like is stipulated. It's like Noah didn't see it coming. We use that one, and then we'll close, because all the others are just repetition of exactly the same thing. 37 through 39. The coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. How? Will there be a flood? It's not just like it that way, is it? No. It's not a flood. There's no boat. Well, how is it just like the days of Noah then, if it's not even going to be wet? It's going to be just like the days of Noah in the way that I tell you it's like the days of Noah. I'm telling you in verse 38. As in the days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The sign of the coming is the abomination of desolation. And the sign that I rule from heaven is when not one stone is left on another. The Old Testament is gone and cannot be practiced in Christianity. It's the last man standing. It's the only game in town. Because they are the people of God and not the Jews. That's what this chapter is about. Every single word. And I will let you go. Brethren, it is not like the days of Noah that it's wet. It's not like the days of Noah that it's the whole planet, which, by the way, after Noah's day was still here anyway. It is like the days of Noah in that you're not going to see it coming. It's like a thief. So I'm going to tell you the generation. I'm going to tell you to be ready. Then, when the gospel's preached in all the oikumene, and you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you'll know to do what? Run for your lives, because desolation is coming. Desolation is coming. And it did. Brethren, the lights went out on the Jews in September of 70 AD. The sky fell. The sun didn't give us light. It was a dark, dark day. And they've been weeping at the foundation ever since, at the Wailing Wall. Class.